Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people and their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for October 24th, right about 2 weeks before Election Day. I guess it's 2 weeks last Tuesday, so within 10 days of Election Day, we're here covering Southern politics. Tonight on the show, we're going to have J.B. Powell, Georgia Agriculture Commissioner candidate, on with us early, and then Matt Glazer of the Burnt Orange Report is going to tell us about all the happenings of Texas politics. And then in the meantime, Tim Shiflett and I are going to cover happenings around the South, Georgia, Arkansas, and otherwise. Evening, Tim.
Good evening, sir. How are you?
Oh, doing good. And also, Catherine Smith may join us later in the show, has had a little something come up, and we wish Catherine the best on that, taking care of that. And if she can come on in, that would be great, too, getting that third perspective. But until JB comes on, why don't we go ahead and talk a little bit about Arkansas politics? And it's kind of a tale of two races. On the governor's side, it's looked good the whole time for Democrats, and on the Senate side, it has not looked good at all. And this week, there was a poll that came out that showed Blanche Lincoln actually gaining some ground. I believe she's up to 41%, which is probably her high watermark for all of 2010. Tim, what do you think is going on there?
From losing by 25 to 30 points to losing by 14, the average of all the polls have her 17 down. I think a couple of things are happening. I think Governor Beebe is pulling her numbers up some because he is, as you just mentioned, winning big. He is one Democratic governor that's had no trouble this year. And more Democrats, I would think, are now engaged out there, including some angry progressives that were thinking of sitting it out. All that said, she'll still lose, but now I just don't think she'll get embarrassed. She was the number one Democratic target, by the way, of the Republicans this cycle, who felt that she was probably the weakest incumbent, and I think they were probably right.
Yeah, and Bozeman's down to 55. I think if you throw registered voters in, she drops Bozeman drops another 2% and closes the race to 11.
We probably have a 58-42, 59-41, 60-40 type race there now.
That's if she doesn't break even, maybe a little more undecided. Now, there is a renewed sense of Democratic vote. I mean, we'll talk about that Newsweek poll later on, and you can just tell that there's a little momentum going there for the Democratic Party. And I don't know that we were discussing this early in the week. Has Bill Clinton visited? And if Bill Clinton visits, I mean, is there some type of chance that Bozeman kind of falls apart and then somehow she, I don't know, the runoff rules, if there's a third candidate that could somehow pull him under 50? I mean, is there any chance she does more than make it a single-digit race?
No. No, and I don't think she's going to make it a single-digit race either. I think she's as close as she's going to get. We're 9 days out, and, you know, probably the polls are settling in about what the race is anyway. I never thought she was going to lose by 30 to 35 points.
Yeah, that seemed too much for a state where within the state of Arkansas, they've got a pretty good Democratic base. I mean,
any momentum she grabs, I really think the governor's coattails are helping her right now more than anything because he's in some polls he's the one running 25 and 30 points ahead. I mean, he is he has been immune to any Republican attacks this year. It's been very interesting to see that tale of two campaigns. It's hard to imagine that there's going to be people that walk in and vote for him and turn around and vote against her, but that's exactly what's going to happen there.
Yeah, and polls are saying that, but I guess if Clinton visits, the best thing to do would also visit Chad Causey's district, because then you get a twofer, and maybe he pulls out that race, which wouldn't hurt the Democratic cause.
If the president comes to Arkansas, don't you think that'll be the real reason that he comes? To see if he can provide any help in those congressional races?
Yeah, and that's the main one, because I think there's one that we don't have a good chance of winning that's an open seat, and there's an incumbent seat where we should hold, and then there's, of course, Bozeman's old seat, which I don't think will win, because Bill Clinton himself didn't win it when he ran back
right.
in the 70s. Well, Tim, I think we're ready for our first guest, State Senator J.B. Powell. Welcome, Senator Powell.
Good afternoon.
Oh, good to have you on the show. Well, thank you for spending some time with us on a busy campaign evening on 10 days before the election.
Yeah, we're getting down to the short rows now. There's no question about that.
Yes, well, you've been running hard. For anybody that's maybe missed out, give us a little bit of background on your biography.
Well, I'm a cattle farmer from Blythe, Georgia. Been raising registered Angus cattle. I run about 100 brood cow here. Mama cows, for some of y'all that don't know what that is, and we have a cow-calf operation here. I've also been in the Georgia State Senate and on the Senate Agriculture Committee for about 6 years now.
Sounds like your background lends itself to the title of the job real well.
Well, I hope so. You know, agriculture is something that I love dearly, and the state of Georgia is something else I love dearly, so it ought to be a good combination.
Yes. Now, you've been in the state Senate for multiple terms now. What made you decide to go ahead and run for statewide office this year?
Well, a few years ago, Tommy Irvin had came to me and asked me about running for his seat when he decided that he was not going to run again. And I gave it some thought, and Terry Coleman was then slated to be our candidate. And then Terry had a change of heart. And I honestly felt like that we needed a candidate in there that wasn't tied so much to the big food processors, and was more inclined to lean towards the people on decisions.
Yes. Now, I'm sure voters throughout rural Georgia understand what the agriculture commissioner can do for the people, but let's say we have a lot of listeners, you know, inside the perimeter of Atlanta, other urban areas. How does the Georgia Agriculture Commissioner's Office work for those folks?
Well, the Agriculture Commissioner's number one job is food safety. And food safety is something that's important to us all. We have so many products that are shipped in from out of state, and most of the food that we eat now comes from over 1,500 miles away. The other thing that the Agriculture Commissioner is going to regulate is weights and measurements, which is also your gas measurements, and then the seed grading, which is something that will come into the rural play. But the biggest portion of the Agriculture Commissioner's job that affects the Atlanta metro area is going to be food safety and weights and measures.
Yes. Well, I don't want to ask all the questions because I got a co-host tonight with me, Tim Shiflett. Tim, I'm going to let you ask some questions of Senator.
Okay, Senator, you have talked a lot about legalization of horse racing in Georgia. If that does indeed come to pass, should the first major horse track be located in the Atlanta area or somewhere else, and why?
Well, what we're asking the legislature to do is to vote, give the people the opportunity to vote on horse racing, number one, and start the ball rolling. The private investors that are going to invest in these facilities are really going to be the ones that decide that, because this isn't going to cost the state of Georgia any money other than the cost of putting it on the ballot. So that's something that's probably going to be decided on by those private investors. And I'm sure the metro area will probably be one of the first places that they go to look and due to the population.
Are we talking about reaping a large financial benefit from this?
Yes, I really have looked at the Deutsch studies and some other information that's been out there, and we're looking at $1 billion annually, which is a conservative estimate on revenue that it'll bring into the state, and then we're looking at 10 to 20,000 jobs. You have a lot of farms that'll start up, breeding programs that'll start up immediately because the horses have to be a couple of years old before they can be ran. So you're looking at the breeding programs that'll pop up over a short period of time once this is approved.
Now, what kind of response have you been getting from voters about this plan?
Well, the response that I've been getting is the voters tell me that the working man and woman can't pay any more taxes. The small businesses, they say they can't afford any more taxes. So we've got to look at new revenue sources, and this doesn't cost the taxpayers anything. This is a win-win situation for them. And that's kind of the response I'm getting is that they don't want to have to pay any more. They want new revenue, us to find new revenue sources.
Now, in your line of work, when we talk about small business, of course, the small family farm comes to mind. And what are your thoughts on how small family farms can compete against, giant agribusiness for a share of the market?
Well, first of all, let me tell you, they can't hardly compete with these large conglomerates. Seed prices and fertilizer prices have went through the roof, so if they have any acreage, or to amount to anything at all, they're not going to be able to afford to get into the farming business. But the smaller farms that'll start, we need to start moving into a more Georgia-grown for our vegetables and fruit markets. And what we need to do is try to get these small farms back in the field producing these locally grown goods. And it'll be healthier for us, number one. And we're going to have to make a little investment in some flash freezers and possibly some small canneries to have the sustainability of these vegetables and fruits. But if everyone out there will spend $10 more a week on their groceries on a locally grown Georgia product, then we can increase Georgia's agriculture economy almost another $2 billion a year.
Wow. And I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to turn it back over to David. You mentioned on your website agritourism. For the benefit of our listeners, what exactly is that, and why is it important to Georgia?
Well, we've started a program up in the North Georgia. I think you've seen the winery trail up through there. That's what we're talking about with agritourism, that kind of stuff. People coming and visiting these farms and maybe having some trail ride facilities and stuff for the horses, so people can come into these farms and these local growers and tour these operations, and then the wine trail and some other things, and hopefully the horse racing will also be part of that trail. But that's
right.
What we're talking about is bringing folks to Georgia and growing jobs.
Sounds good. Thank you, sir. David?
Yeah, following up on one of Tim's questions about the buying Georgia products, if let's just say the average consumer goes into a Kroger or a Publix and their neighborhood wants to buy a Georgia-grown product, is there a way now that they could easily identify that, or is that something you plan to institute where they could more easily identify it?
Well, that's something that's what we want to do is to label the product and get it out there as a labeled product and a certified product, like the Vidalia onion, for instance. That's kind of what we're talking about right there.
Okay.
How when you go in and you have the certified Vidalia onion, then you know what you're getting, and it's local, and it only comes from Vidalia.
Yeah. Yes, okay. Makes a lot of sense. Now, you've been campaigning throughout the state. How's the campaign going?
Well, I think it's going very well. We've touched every area of Georgia that we've had time to get into. We've been in the Northeast. We've been in the Northwest. We've been in Central Georgia and in South Georgia, and just trying to meet a lot of people, seeing some things that I never knew that existed in Georgia. And it's just been a great time. We've been working hard, but we've also had a very, very good trip along the way.
Yes. Now, if someone logged onto your campaign website, and you can give the address out as part of that, how could they get involved in your campaign?
Well, we need all the help we can get in every campaign. We'd like y'all to come out and join our campaign. You can go on votejbpowell.com, and that can tell you exactly how to come in and all the things that you can do to help us. And we just appreciate any help we can get, because we want to make Georgia's agriculture grow. And it's going to take us all to do that in these hard times.
Yes, well, we thank you for coming on. Is there anything else that you wanted to let the voters know before now and Election Day?
Well, I think the one thing that I want the voters to look at is the difference in all the candidates. And I'm a farmer. I'm not a big food company lobbyist. And my only special interest is the people of Georgia and not the big businesses. And I think that's what you're going to find as you do your research. But I hope that you'll come on and join our team, and we can move these things together and make Georgia's agriculture economy grow without having to make major investments.
Yes, well, thanks again, and best of luck to you next Tuesday at the polls.
I thank you, and I thank the people of Georgia for the opportunity.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Yes, well, I think Senator Powell's right about his background. Being a farmer, I had no idea that he had such a background in farming until he came on with us. And obviously cattle farming, they have a real vested interest in what Agriculture Commissioner's office does.
Yeah, you know, my question would be, why would a candidate for Agriculture Commissioner not be a farmer? You know, it would seem that would be the ideal place to choose an agriculture commissioner from. And, you know, the voters of Georgia need to think about that between now and November the 2nd when they go and vote.
Yeah, well, and he was right about food safety. I think a lot of folks think, well, I'm not a farmer, what do I care? But, I mean, obviously, you know, food safety and recalls is huge. And then,
yeah,
you know, gas pump safety and different things like that.
Well, you know, before we move on, a lot of people think that some of these down ballot races and the jobs they fill don't affect their daily lives. But if anyone was listening just then, the job of agriculture commissioner in Georgia is an extremely important one. I mean, agriculture is one of the economic backbones of this state, not to mention the things about food safety. So people should think about that. And if there's some people, and you know they do that, David, they'll go in and they'll vote on like the governor's race and maybe the U.S. Senate race and just leave some of the down ballot races blank. They should never do that.
Yes, I mean, that's why, you know, and it may not be good for us in today's environment, but there are some states where you can just say, look, I want to vote for the entire Democratic ticket, or I want to vote for the entire Republican ticket, and Georgia's not one of those states, but that would at least get votes counted in those races. But
right,
people just have to be disciplined enough to do it on their own, I guess. And that, Tim, that segues into a topic that I think is very, very important to talk about this week, but not fun to talk about. Landmark Communications came out with a poll, and I'm sure a lot of people looked at some of the horse race numbers in the governor's race, lieutenant governor's race, and you know, but to me, those numbers were not a lot different than some we've seen. We actually saw an Insider Advantage poll, I think it was, early in the week that showed us catching up a bit in the governor's race on the Democratic side, which was nice. But these Landmark Communications numbers were very, very sobering, and that was page one. They asked people if you vote only for Republicans, mostly for Republicans, only for Democrats, mostly for Democrats. And if you look at white voters, which are a majority of voters in Georgia, the only for Republicans number among white voters, 51%. The mostly voting for Republican is 25% once you round up. And then if you combine the mostly and only for Democrat numbers, white voters, you don't quite get to 18, but let's go ahead and be generous and say 18%. Now, hopefully those numbers are a little bit wrong. But, I mean, even if they're 5 points wrong, that only gets you to 23. Tim, is there any way we can get statewide election wins when we can't get better numbers than 25% or 23%, in this case 18 if you want to use these numbers, in the biggest voting block in Georgia?
No, not in congressional election years especially, because normally in congressional election years, voters are two things historically. They're older and whiter. There are some studies showing that African-American participation may be down by as much as one-third nationwide. This year, we can't take a hit like that in Georgia. Matt Towery gives a baseline of 23% of the vote needs to be African American, or we're in the soup. And I would tend to agree with him. Over 70% of the voters are white, and when 51% of them say that they're going to always vote for the Republicans, that's a big chunk. We're not going to win like that. We got to do something to get white voters back. We're even losing the female vote in Georgia. If you saw that all that poll, David, we can't win like that. Democrats really need to run well among female voters, and we're just not doing it. There's a lot of reasons why this has happened. A lot of it started happening 45 years ago. You know, you can go back and look and see what happened. But yeah, we're going to have to do better than this, or we're not going to win any statewide races.
Yeah, and really, this is a topic where, I mean, there's not much that can be done about this between now and Election Day 2010.
Nope.
This is a much more systemic issue. But, I mean, even if you look at the numbers, and you look at that first page and you look at age, 18, voters 18 to 35, the most Democratic age bracket, 33.1 only for Republicans, 33.1 only for Democrats. Then when you look for the mostly numbers, you get about a 1.9 advantage for Democrats. And that is it. Where the only place for white voters lead, or Democrats lead white voters.
Well, I mean, what happens in the best-case scenario if these numbers hold? Well, we saw what happened 2 years ago. That was the best-case scenario where young voters, African-American voters, in record numbers surged to the polls here in Georgia, and the president still lost by 5 points in a race he won in a landslide. That's the best-case scenario right now. We have to change these numbers that you quoted, or we're not going to win. I mean,
I don't know if these numbers are gospel, but I know this. If you look at the exit polling data that was in the book put out by Chuck Todd and the other fellow for NBC News, and that was exit poll data, which is considered a little more hard and fast, it wasn't much better than some among white voters. I have a feeling if they do exit polling data after this election, you know, we may sneak up into the, you know, into the 20s. But it's a real problem. Tim, we got a caller. We have elicited another caller. Welcome. What you got to tell us on the Kudzu Vine?
How are you?
Hey, is this our caller from last week?
Maybe. I don't know.
Well, tell us your name and where you're from.
My name's Tony, and I'm from Florida.
Tony from Florida. Well, yeah, I believe you called in last week. So,
yeah,
Tony, what's on your mind?
Yeah, no, I agree with what you guys are saying. I think what you're saying, it is a systemic issue. It does go back some 40 years to about the time of John Kennedy, and we've been losing middle-class white-collar workers for a long time. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, Democrats don't necessarily reach out to those people. And I think we need to start reaching out to, I mean, it's they're part of the community. And I think that we need to start reaching out to those people and informing those people, because there's a infrastructure in place informationally where the right reaches those people on a daily basis, you know, with talk radio and so forth. And a lot of these people have some unusual ideas. And they're not right, and I've listened to quite a bit of. I mean, fundamentally wrong. We're not talking about opinions now. We're talking about facts. And you know, we need to get those facts. We need to be clearer with our message and reaching out to people. And I think also the middle class white vote likes a stronger candidate. And I don't think Democrats, you know, it's been a long time since Harry Truman, you know, and we don't have candidates like that anymore. I mean, as stubborn as Barack Obama is, and he's a very strong, stubborn human being, he's not very vocal. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he knows how to he knows how to give a speech, but he doesn't get steamed. He doesn't do a Teddy Roosevelt. You know, he doesn't do a Harry Truman. We need people who are going to get steamed up, because if you look at a lot of these politicians, if you look at the leader of the Senate, Barnard.
Right.
He's got that very strong, you know, we're losing jobs. They're very, that very Bob Dole type of, you know, I mean, not that you have to scream and yell, but I mean, he's got that very forceful, you see those, that kind of very forceful feeling coming out of people on the right. And we need more people like that. You look at Jerry Brown in California. He's like that, and look at where he is. He's going to – Meg Whitman has outspent him. She spent almost $200 million between the primary and the mainstream race, and he's going to beat her. And he's going to beat her by some 10 points. And he's going to beat her because he is a politician who stands up and says, look, I'm not going to take your bull. I'm going to tell you right where it's at. And I'm not going to hide or kowtow on issues or let you get away with hitting me with something that's not true. Go ahead.
I know what you're saying, Tony. And what's kind of sad about that is when in 2004 we had a candidate that was played linebacker in high school football, was a college hockey player. And our opponent was a guy that was a college cheerleader, and yet the college cheerleader was seen like the more testosterone-driven candidate, and we couldn't do much about it, so I know exactly what you're talking about. Tony, thanks again for calling in for us tonight, and keep listening, and call every week. It's great. But right now, I think we've got our next guest on calling in from Texas, Matt Glazer from the Burnt Orange Report. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, guys. It's good to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. You're on just with Tim and Catherine tonight. Matt, we just got so fascinated by Texas because it looks like a place where it's a southern state, where Democrats haven't been doing well, and finally a Democratic statewide candidate is showing a real chance of possible winning this thing. Is our view from Georgia correct about Bill White's chances?
It's going to be a tough race, and it's been a tough race the entire time. I think that Bill White's got a really great chance. He's got a backbone, and he's really showing it. And he's won every statewide a newspaper endorsement here in the last 2 weeks, and has been on TV consistently since the end of summer. If there was a Democrat that was going to win, this would be the guy. But it's a tough political climate. It's a tough political climate nationally, and that's even more true in a state where Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff have redistricted it and gerrymandered it in a way where almost every district is meant to be a Republican district. We've done a good job over the past couple of years coming back, but it's going to still be a tough election, and we really need a lot of people to turn out, and we need some of those disenfranchised Democrats that we've created over the past decade to wake up and see that there's a victory on the horizon.
Yes. Now, I know the polls have shown each candidate in the, I guess, mid-40s. One thing Tim and I were talking about in Georgia, because there's a poll released with some crosstabs, and they asked just basically based on different demographic categories, do you support Democrats or Republicans most of the time, all the time? What is kind of the base white Democratic vote in Texas right now?
Right now, he's polling anywhere from 43% to 45%, depending on the poll you're looking at. Rick Perry has only crossed the 50% mark in Republican-leaning polls from, like, GOPAC and Rasmussen. So we're feeling a little optimistic just based on the polling numbers that we have been seeing. I would guess that we're seeing a 3.5-point game at this point, where any point in time, either candidate is within about 3 points of each other. The thing that's been interesting is looking at all these polls and looking at all these crosstabs for the past 60, 90 days is that traditionally they undersample Hispanics and they undersample African Americans, and those are two rapidly growing voter bases here in Texas. And so, you know, if they're going to continue to undersample those demographics, I think that we got to say that this is a 1 or 2 point game.
Wow, that is good news. Now, one more thing caught my eye on the governor's race, and then Tim may have all kind of other questions. There's been an issue about where the governor should live. Apparently there's some type of remodeling or something going to the mansion. You can tell us more about that. But Rick Perry's apparently spending lots of money to live somewhere, and Bill White has pledged to go ahead and move into a mobile unit to save cost. Tell us some background on that story and tell us how that move by Mr. White is playing.
Well, that's a really interesting story. It sort of goes back to the days when there was the governor's renovation in Arkansas when Mike Huckabee was governor, and he actually lived in a double-wide trailer while the renovation was going on. Rick Perry, not to be, not to go and do the sort of frugal thing, has used taxpayer money to spend $10,000 a month in a luxurious rental mansion in the suburbs of Austin. My company, GNI Strategies, we've been doing a program called Evict Rick, which you can find on Facebook, evictrick.com, and sort of around the website or around the interwebs. We've been sort of highlighting what's been going on with this rental mansion scandal, and it's been playing really well. People are really, really frustrated by the fact that we have a $21 to $26 billion shortfall here in the state of Texas. We have not gotten exact numbers because Rick Perry has stopped the comptroller for doing any audits, and he's spending $10,000 a month on a rental mansion of taxpayer money. This is just not playing well. He's getting a lot of pushback on it. And so Bill White has said that, you know, if elected governor, we're going to go ahead and start doing the renovations again on the mansion. We are going, while that's going on, he was going to live in a double-wide trailer right next to the Capitol and basically just do the sort of prudent thing and be a good governor and watch the bottom line. The really, really interesting thing, though, about this mansion issue is that the mansion was being renovated back two and a half years ago just sort of because it needed to be done. But during, I think, South by Southwest 2 years ago, arson happened. A gentleman walked by, threw a Molotov cocktail, and burned most of the mansion, and at least the outer parts burned it pretty bad. Well, that structure burned has been sitting there, not being renovated, not being repaired, just sitting there deteriorating for 2 years now. In the meantime, Governor Perry has used federal money to balance the budget, and part of the call that he asked for federal money for was for mansion renovation. So this thing has just been sitting there for 2 years, unused, unfixed, and slowly deteriorating. There's a growing concern in the architecture community that we may actually have to demolish or destroy chunks or the entire Texas governor's mansion.
Yes, and I guess that'd be a loss of history if it's been used for many decades.
Yeah, it's one of the only governor's mansions that also served as the president's house in the sense that Texas was a republic on its own. So this has had a dual purpose for us, and it's sort of a you know, sentimental thing. Us Texans, we love our history, and we love the fact that we used to be our own country, even if it was just for a short period of time. And I'd hate to see a little piece of that history die off because of the word. I have no word to describe Rick Perry right now.
Yes, well, let me pass this over to Tim to ask some questions about the governor's race.
Yes, sir. There is one biggie I want to ask you about. We have all read and heard the stories this year about the alleged dirty pool the GOP has been playing with the Green Party pretty much to get them on the ballot. First of all, how much of this stuff about the Green Party's connection to the GOP is true? And the second question is, what sort of effect is the Green Party having on the governor's race?
Well, the Green Party is not having much of an impact on the governor's race. In fact, the Libertarian candidate, Kathy Glass, seems to be getting more traction out of any other third-party candidate. And she's polling anywhere from 5 to 8%. That's one of the reasons why just fundamentally believe whoever wins our race for governor is going to win it with less than 50%. Rick Perry only won it with 39% 4 years ago. I don't think it's going to be that low, but it's going to be probably in the mid to high 40s for whoever wins. But what we do know for a fact is that some Republican consultants and Republican operatives paid $200,000 to help get the Green Party of Texas on the ballots. That's sort of not quite on my
Matt, technical difficulty. Sorry there.
Oh, it's okay. Do you need to say anything else? Did you guys miss any of that? Or
yeah, repeat about. We heard the part about the $200,000, and then you went out on us for a second.
Okay. So Republican consultants were paid about $200,000 to help get the Green Party on the ballot. And it looks like Republicans paid to do this operation. That's really not in dispute. The Green Party sort of director of the state of Texas, Kat Swift, has more or less admitted to that and has said that she didn't approve of the way it was done, but that is what happened. What we do know for a fact, too, is that a district court judge in Travis County was so confused and concerned by the fact that the Republican Party had paid to get the Green Party on the ballot that there was, for at least a short term, a stay where the Secretary of State's ballot was not going to have the Green Party on there. That was later reversed by a Republican-elected judge, so the Green Party is going to be on the ballot. What we have also seen is that there has been a strong push because the comptroller's race is really not disputed. It's a Republican and a Green Party candidate and a Libertarian candidate. That there is concern now that the Green Party is going to get their necessary 5% to be sort of grandfathered into the next round of elections where they're not going to have to go through this petition process. So it's sort of a shame that the Republican Party is going to long-term really screw with Democrats in this way, and that the Green Party has sold out its philosophies and its platform to the Republicans for a short-term game. I don't think that they're going to influence any of the statewide races in any big way, but there's a distinct possibility that they may influence some of the down-ballot races by just 2 or 3% here or there. And we have had about 8 state house races decided by and about 4 or 5 points. So that could be a huge swing for us, and we're trying to be mindful of that in these suburban Democratic districts.
Okay, now you mentioned also in the governor's race that the Libertarian candidate has been routinely polling anywhere from 5 to 8%. Is it possible that they actually have that level of strength, or is this going to be one of those deals where they're going to get about 2 or 3%, do you think, on election day?
There's a lot of voter fatigue with Rick Perry. After 10 years as governor and 25 years as a career politician, he's really got a track record of doing the wrong thing. He mandated that little girls were going to have an HPV vaccine without any parental input, and that thankfully was overturned by the legislature. He has made us have a $26 billion shortfall in our budget. He's now been supervising two different budget shortfalls. The first time he balanced the budget on the backs of minorities, of the impoverished, of children, of working parents, on teachers, and we've not gotten caught up to those 2003 cuts. So there's a long track record of his failures. I think this fatigue with Rick Perry and his failures are showing that, or we're seeing those in Kathy Glass's numbers. She is anti-Perry. She is sort of the voice of the true Tea Party. She's a grassroots activist. She's running a real race. And while it's not raising the sort of Bill White, Rick Perry numbers, it's probably the most money I've seen in 4 to 6 years from a third-party candidate at any level. And she's been on TV. It's got a nice website. I think her numbers are going to be real. Are they going to hit 8%? I don't know. But Deborah Medina in the primary got, I think, somewhere around 20, 21% because of just the hostility towards Kay Bailey Hutchison and Rick Perry. I don't think she's going to hit anywhere close to those numbers, but I think Kathy Glass has got some real support at a real guttural level.
Okay, and one final question on the governor's race, and then I'll throw it back to David. The latest poll, national poll, Rasmussen, from 3 or 4 days ago, showed the race in the high single digits. Is that your sense of where the race is right now, or is it a little bit closer than that?
Well, we've seen a Rasmussen poll that says that this race is drifting more and more towards Perry. I just don't buy that. You know, Rick Perry's not doing any real field operations. He bought his TV late because he couldn't get the financial support to buy TV on time. He hasn't been doing any grassroots activism at any level, and he's been playing a shell game by looking like a new media guru, but he's done auto calls into Iowa. So he's not focused on the race in Texas. He's focused on the race in Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina in 2012. And we're seeing that across the board. And so what we're kind of telling the national folks and anybody who wants to listen is we apologize about George W. Bush, but this time we've warned you. This time we've seen the writing on the wall. We've seen that our governor wants to run for president or vice president, and we can't do anything without national support to stop it. It takes everybody from across the country to put in $25 or to share something on their social networks and to do these kind of conversations like we're doing to really say that this race is close, because people don't want to believe that Texas is trending purple, that Texas is one cycle behind what Virginia is right now. And so it takes having those conversations to really make an influence. I fundamentally believe that this race is a 3 to 4 point game right now. I fundamentally believe that Bill White's campaign is better on the grassroots level and the field organizing, and a really good field organization can move the needle by 5-6%, and it will never be pulled. We saw that with Barack Obama. We're seeing that here in Texas. I think that we could wake up on November 3rd and be pleasantly surprised by a Democratic governor in Texas.
Well, boy, I hope you're right there. David?
Yeah, that'd be real good news. Well, Matt, we know you're a political consultant and things get kind of tight. Do you have any more time to talk congressional races, or do you need to run and help your clients?
I got to run. I got to do some voter targeting models for judicial candidates the rest of the night. But, I mean, I'm happy to try to come back on later in the week or next weekend if possible.
Well, maybe what we'll do is we'll have you on after Election Day, and we can talk about how Texas is becoming back to a Democratic state in the model of Sam Ervin and LBJ.
That sounds great. From your mouth to God's ear.
There we go.
Thanks again, Matt.
Thank you, sir.
Good night.
Yeah, well, I know Matt he's got a lot of clients, so I didn't want to be too, I'll be mindful of his time. And if you want to read more about what Matt has to write, go to burnorangereport.com, the best blog covering Texas politics. So you can see Matt's stuff there and some of his colleagues that write on there as well. Well, that was just good news about Texas. I mean, it's just kind of something I didn't see coming, if you will, and I've just been so glad to see it. Tim, what do you think?
Well, you know, don't you want to believe that White, Mayor White, can pull it off out there? But it just almost seems like when you watch these polls of that race, you see him reaching out there, and he just can't quite seem to blow by Perry. I wish one poll, just one poll, would show him getting by Governor Perry, but you just wonder if that's going to be possible. I Rasmussen had it an 8-point race. I think it's probably 5 to 8 points right now. What do you think?
Well, but the good news or the trick is if this renewed Democratic surge comes through, and this race was already tight, but, Perry just can't get over 50%, this could be one we could really win. I mean, if you talk about governor's races in the South, you'd have to say Florida and Texas are the best shots for us. Other than maybe
outside of Arkansas, where we're going to win anyway, yeah.
But of the seats where we either don't hold them or they're open, or don't hold them. I mean, Georgia may be an open seat, Alabama may be an open seat, but we don't hold them. So that's what I'm saying. I think those are some of our best shots. And so you got to think, well, if that surge happens, then that's where it comes up. And actually, Newsweek just came up with a poll, and Newsweek, usually I know I hadn't seen the crosstabs on this, but they usually poll a pretty big sample when they do a poll. I mean, they're known to get up to, 1,000 people, 900 people, so they can control their numbers a little better. Well, they came out with a poll that actually showed Democrats leading the generic ballot test. That's like probably the first poll to show that. The president's approval rating was up to 54%. The enthusiasm gap had closed. It was like every number, and apparently President Clinton's numbers kind of did this too, and then the Democrats didn't, have a good year in, I guess, 94. But what do you make of this poll? Is this good news, or is this just an outlier?
I'll be honest with you. I don't believe it. I don't. I believe the president's approval rating is somewhere between 45% and 50%, and I believe his disapproval rating is right along in that range too. And look, there is no way the Democrats have a 6-point lead on the generic ballot when every other poll in the world out there is showing a better than 5-point lead for the Republicans. And I'm not talking about just Rasmussen. I'm talking about people like CNN, that are showing, a 5 to 7 point generic lead for the Republicans. And I'm looking at a breakdown of House races that show that right now the Republicans already have over 220 House seats wrapped up. And no, I don't believe it for a minute. I'm sorry, I just don't. I'd love to, of course, but no, I'm going to say outlier, David.
Okay, I mean, this is Princeton Survey Research, 2-day poll, 1,005 adults. I see it, they actually use phones and cell phones, although really I guess if you used only phones, what they've said in the last cycle or two is that would then tend to be more Republican vote because it's a little older. So, I guess you take good news when you can get it.
Yeah, you do, but then I look at all of these other polls. Pew Research, Republicans by 10. Associated Press, Republicans by 7. Rasmussen, Republicans by 9. Gallup, Republicans by 11. Fox News by 9. CNN by 7. And then all of a sudden here comes Newsweek saying, advantage Democrats. No, sorry. Gotta have some confirming polls that say the same thing.
Yeah.
That got you quiet. But sorry.
I mean, it's kind of one of those things we can both say, hey, we think this is right, or no, we don't think this is right. But, until Election Day, we just won't know who's right.
I do think one poll don't tell a story, but a combination of all of them do. And the combination of all of them, it's just frankly telling a totally different story from this one right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, Tim, I guess I was a little dark on the landmark poll, but particularly, what I see as a systemic problem in this state. But I'm a little more optimistic on the country in general.
I remember one thing, too. Landslides don't stop at state lines. if this is a wave election, we're not going to pick off this one and pick off that and then pick off the other one. Our safest seats, of course, which are the majority of seats, are going to be safe. But we're going to lose some of the low-hanging fruit, some people that won races in 06 and 08 that, frankly, probably should not have won. We're going to lose those people. And, more importantly, we're going to lose a lot of the junk balls, these races that are too close to call. We're going to lose those. And the main reason we're going to lose those is their voters are more engaged in coming out to vote, and ours are not.
Right. Yeah, and I did see another number of people that have already voted, early voters, and I don't think this is the case in Georgia. It may not be in other southern states. We actually lead those voters. Did you see that similar number?
Yeah, in a total of the numbers nationwide, we do lead in those numbers. There's a mighty big but there. A lot more Republican voters this year than before. Targeted states like Florida, for instance, the majority of early vote has been Republican. Nevada, the majority of early vote has been Republican. Now, see, these are those toss-up races I'm talking about.
When you look state by state, it's not the picture we'd want, but, I mean, it's just,
no.
It seems like, obviously,
it's
if you look 2-3 months ago, it's just really grim, and it's less grim.
Well, I mean, there's more of a chance now, for instance, of us holding the Senate. That's where the late Democratic surge, if there is one, is starting to show up. And it's showing up in the more progressive bastions, places like New York State. California is a prime example. Tony, you know, when he called, mentioned Jerry Brown. Brown has been outspent more than 10-1, and he's starting to pull away a little bit out there. So, you know,
a lot of times, general trends trump money spent,
right,
if you will.
Pretty much, right.
So, you know, it's going to be something we continue to watch. I'm sure we'll have an old other batch of poll numbers nationwide even, too, to look
well,
at.
Well, yeah, we're getting flooded every day with polls now, so.
Yeah, and there's just so many. Now, some of the state-by-state ones begin to get a little more interesting. And I guess staying on polls, I hadn't seen a lot of polling on South Carolina. And the State House report, which is by Andy Brack, who's been a guest on our show, he joined up with Insider Advantage, and they put together a poll of all the races. And, you know, it doesn't look good in the governor's race. It's about a 14-point race. If you look down the ticket, the Republicans are leading by, you know, decent margins in every single race except for the state school superintendent's race. And that's the only statewide office right now that's held by Democrats. What is it about South Carolina where they stay Democratic on the state school superintendent? And, you know, Georgia doesn't do this. Georgia, Linda Shrinko was the first statewide takeover of any office way back in 1994. Do you have any idea why South Carolina seems to trust Democrats more on educating children than any other governmental issue?
Number one, they should. But I know I don't understand that. And another thing I didn't understand, that South Carolina poll, if you look at it, there's a pretty good gap in most of the races. The lieutenant governor's race is a 5-point race. Now, why is that? Why is the lieutenant governor's race a 5-point race and the governor's race right above it a 14-point race?
Yeah, and I don't know much about Ken Ard and Ashley Cooper to have any idea, like, you know, if there's a reason that one's more popular than the other. I mean, you know, it could get into that. Obviously, just a general trend issue, the governor's race is going to take over on it. One's a Florence City councilman. The other's an attorney, university professor. So it's not like one has this job that carries the day. I did see an article on that same front page of the State House report that said the forgotten men So, you know, they've kind of forgotten both of them, if you will. But
you know, as wild as that state has been in the news for the last year, this the latter part of this election cycle is strangely quiet there, isn't it? You're not hearing nothing out of South Carolina now.
Well, I guess they needed to calm down. And honestly, there's a lot of places you're just not – if there's nothing on the national issues that have a lot of juice or a race that's close, really the governor's races in a lot of states hadn't had a lot of traction. I think for all the money spent, if you take away the ads, I don't think in Georgia there's been a lot of interest.
No,
think
about it in the South. Outside of Florida, do we even have a toss-up race in any governor's race in the South?
You
got a high single-digit race according to the polls, but in Florida, you've got a neck-and-neck race, and you hear a lot about that governor's race, but you don't seem to hear a lot about the others.
And that race goes back and forth. Although I will say, Tim, do you hear more about that governor's race because people then look at the Senate race, and while they're polling on one, they might as well poll on the other. I'm not so sure that the Senate race there didn't get a lot of interest and then shine a little more interest on.
It'll certainly bring more voters to the polls, but the Senate race is a 15-point race. I know that there's three candidates in the race, and the dynamic would be quite different if there were two. But it would seem to me, if I were living in the state of Florida, that first and foremost, I would be interested in that governor's race because, frankly, I think that one's going to keep us up late at night on election night.
I think you're right. And according to the St. Petersburg Times poll, that race has flipped back, and Rick Scott's up 44-41. I tell you, the picture they use, if you like people with long, thin necks, you're a toss-up there. Cause that's one thing they both share.
If you poll all the polls, recent polls taken to Florida, it shakes out to a one-point lead for Scott. That's as close as you can get.
And there's still a ton of a ton of undecided vote, because if you look at this, there's 15% undecided
vote.
That truly
is a race that's going to be determined by who gets their voters out. Truly.
Yeah, and then it says he has the smallest advantage over a Democrat when compared to the three Republican colleagues who bet their rivals with double-digit leads. For the other three constitutional offices. And then what I love is you have these commenters now on all the articles and the internet. It just brings us such great stuff. And you have somebody that says Alex Sink equals Barack Obama, and then it apparently blames her for the unemployment, even though she is the chief financial officer, which I don't believe has anything to do with employment.
Well, I tell you what, she is the best candidate we could have run for that office this year. And frankly, if the Republican primary voters had chosen differently down there a little while back, we wouldn't be talking about that governor's race because it would be over. So if they lose it on election night, it's going to be nobody's fault but theirs, because once again, here's one of these Tea Party candidates that's trying his best to blow a race that normally they should win, and he's doing a pretty darn good job of that, isn't he?
Yes, but I'm just so shocked at how the Republicans keep using the same old thing. They've used it in Georgia. They've used it in South Carolina. I bet there's some evidence that the RGA uses this in every southern state in particular, where they take a picture of the president, they take a picture of the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, they morph between them, and they find any correlation they possibly can. They both breathe oxygen. You know, Barack Obama, Roy Barnes, they both walk on 2 feet. You know, whatever they can do, they're just two peas in a pod. I saw the same one with
in Georgia,
the one on
you
Pence
think,
Dehaene was a joke.
Yeah, well, in Georgia, you'd think it'd be more likely that Nancy Pelosi would be our gubernatorial candidate than Roy Barnes would be, to hear the Republicans tell it. Because what are they saying? Barack Obama, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, blah, 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 blah. And they're doing that in races all over the country. I can't say that's a bad move, you know, this year. It might be. But, you know,
It's such a dumb move, Tim, because, I mean, honestly, Roy Barnes and Barack Obama have never held even statewide office at the same point in time. Additionally, the one with Vincent Shaheen, it said Vincent Shaheen, another Columbia liberal. Is there even such a thing as a Columbia, South Carolina liberal?
They are in the same party. And the president's approval rating is in the 30s in Georgia. And frankly, if I were the Republicans, I would probably be doing the same thing.
But Tim, honestly, I've been to Columbia, South Carolina. I didn't ever get the sense I was in San Francisco or Berkeley, places that, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, places that are, you know, supposedly bastions of liberalism. But
yeah.
Columbia, South Carolina liberal. I mean, it's just they've got the advantage in a lot of ways, but they're coming up with the most pitiful, desperate attacks. But I'm sure we'll see more of them last night.
We've run
the next
past
9 days.
Our time.
We are, and that's what I was about to. Yeah, I'm about to close this thing up. Well, Tim, I think you and I have carried the load pretty well. We've had some great guests. I want to thank them, and I'm sure Catherine will be back next week for the final show before Election Day. 2010.
Good night.
Night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force?